Hopping along the brace there.
You know what I wonder about?
Meg laughed. Why tranquilizers don't work on you? Prater ignored her.
Where do they live?
What do you mean? They have houses and stuff. We saw it on the recon.
Yeah, but I mean, what do they do there?
Prater dropped her legs and rolled onto her side, carefully keeping her injured hand on her hip.
They don't sleep, so why do they have houses? What do they do there?
Meg squinted at her in the red filtered light. We do more than sleep in our houses.
But think about it. Why do we have houses in the first place? Every creature on Earth sleeps, right? Everything sleeps. And everything, on land at least, is vulnerable while it sleeps. It digs a hole or builds a burrow or climbs a tree so that it can sleep. It makes a safe place so it can sleep and its kids can sleep, right? That's the whole reason humans banded together in the first place. To light the fire and circle the wagons and be safe in the dark while we slept.
True.
So why do they have houses? How big are they? Are they just like, here's my kitchen and my closet and, here's where I stay awake all the time? See what I mean? What the hell do they do all day? When there aren't aliens invading their planet, I mean.
Meg thought about that. Well, they have families. They have entertainment. Movies and TV and stuff. I guess they just have a lot more time for it.
Man.
Prater kicked her toes together, her voice thickening with sleep.
Can you imagine if you never had to sleep? How much you could get done? That'd be awesome.
It would be awful. I loved sleep. She pulled the sheet up to her chin even though she wasn't cold. Heat came off Prater's body in waves. I love dreams, even bad ones. Prater snickered.
You like sleep because you get to get busy with Dr. Cho, Evil Eye. You like to get your hands on all those mojo signs he's got on his body.
You're one to talk. I've heard more than one bump and grind groan coming from your tent. Getting a little orange slice, are ya? They both giggled at the slur. After a few generations, the minerals in the Galen colony's soil had added a copper tinge to the resident's skin. The Galens wore it with pride, but were not above throwing a fist if someone cast aspersions upon their skin tone. Prater made it her mission to bring it up to Jefferson at every opportunity. He took it in stride, referring to himself as her personal vitamin C. Prater yawned large, her breath sour from her steady diet of grow-all beans.
Well, just between you and me, I think Jeff and the captain are trading more than data packets, if you know what I mean.
She rolled onto her back, her injured hand cradled to her stomach. What? Meg asked, sitting up. You gotta be kidding me. Prater said nothing, her breathing soft and even. Now you fall asleep? After that little nugget of gossip? She flopped back down, shaking her head. A rough rasping started beside her. Of course Prater would snore. Lul tried not to show his relief when he saw that Cho wasn't going into stasis with Meg. That meant the Effins would be busy and he would have time to think. He wanted so badly to talk with Poe and Reno Dotto, especially Reno Dotto. Of all the crazy alien stuff she had laughed at over the years, she had always believed that psychics could hear vibrations from people. She had even taken meditation courses trying to align her vibrations with her true vocation. Poe had ridiculed her for it, but Lul had managed to keep a straight face. He couldn't wait to tell her she'd been right. Sort of. Meg had been more preoccupied with her injured crewmate and the treatment Cho provided than with Lul's disappointment at her need for stasis. After all these rounds, he still felt that ache when he knew she would disappear for at least a shift. He was getting better at sensing when her stasis was due. The Urfers followed a time schedule that worked independently of the shifting colors of the suns. According to Cho, via the Effins, their bodies functioned on an Urf rhythm that couldn't be altered. The more strictly these rhythms were observed, the better the Urfers functioned. Even with the schedule, each Urfer spent several moments after stasis unprepared to return to work. Meg called those periods mourning. Cho warned the Effens that because he was missing his normal stasis shift, he might become less energetic as they worked. Meg had laughed at that, recording the word grumpy into the language program. When Lul went to repeat it, she touched no and laughed. More Urfer humor. Whatever grumpy meant, if Cho didn't go down with Meg, that meant the Effens would be occupied while Meg was gone. Before she climbed into her shelter, Lul tapped her arm, resting his knuckles on her wristband. She'd stared at him and then grinned. Yes. She unbuckled the thin band and handed it to him. Lul read words. Lul open screen? He tried to replicate the pinching movement she used to draw the screen from the red light, but nothing happened. Meg drew the screen out for him, showing him how to balance it on his fingertips so it wouldn't close when he moved. He watched the screen fill with text boxes, pictures, and symbols, all filling in with the ever-improving Kartar vocabulary interface. He balanced the incorporeal thing on his fingertips, afraid to move. She smiled, patting his arm. Screen no good, then ask Cho. Cho make screen good. Okay? He wanted to tap his knuckles, but didn't want to disturb the screen.
Okay,
he said, rising up with the light above his hands.
Lul read.
Meg smiled, and he stepped away to make room for Prater and Cho to climb in after her. She hadn't given him any warning about the screen. She hadn't made any sign to hide anything or change the program in any way that he could tell. Surely she understood that he was going to look through the files, and as his language filled in the gaps, he would understand what he saw there. That meant she wasn't hiding anything, right? He didn't kid himself about the very real probability that anything secret wouldn't be on this database to begin with. Even he, a lowly weather watcher, had access and passwords for classified files. Information could be hidden. As he made his way across the worksite, moving as carefully as possible so nothing would happen to the screen, he kept his eye on the numbers ticking down in the upper right corner of the screen. He had a theory, and he had at least a shift alone to work on it. He had 08-42-33 to work on it, whatever that meant. The 33 counted down so quickly he could hardly follow it, and by the time he made it to his booth, he had 08-39-57. He didn't just watch the numbers ticking off. That made him too nervous. Maybe it was nothing. Maybe it was part of the clock that kept their rigid sleeping and eating schedule. Maybe it was nothing more than the battery life of whatever was powering this computer. He poked around on the screen, listening to the strange pastiche of recordings putting together phrases. Maybe those numbers didn't mean anything important, but Meg never covered them up. She never explained them, but she never let them disappear. Meg was many things, mysterious, expressive, and enthralling, but she wasn't careless. She kept her eye on those numbers. He realized the screen didn't respond as well to the rough skin of his fingers, often skipping commands and falling silent. When he opened his pads, however, the boxes lit up easily, the screen rolling through the prompts as it did for Meg. He pulled up photographs of Earth and lost himself in images of rolling seas and grassy plains, huge buildings and crowded squares. In some ways, it didn't seem that different from Didet. The people obviously looked a lot different, and their clothes were nothing like the Urfers on site wore. The clothes in photographs were full of color and pressed into strange shapes and designs. Sometimes everyone in a picture wore the same outfit. Sometimes everyone dressed differently, but so many of the pictures could have passed for badly developed Didet photos. If the film got overexposed and somehow the images lengthened so that the people were longer and paler, he could almost see the pictures of his own family gathered around at different events. People smiled, crowded in close. Babies were held up to cameras, and there were even pictures of mothers and fathers pressing their lips into the spot where the baby's rose spots should have been. He could spend all day looking at the pictures. He scrolled through, looking for the photos Meg had spoken of when Earth was in darkness. Night, she called it. But since there was no word equivalent in Kartar, he couldn't scan for it that way. He couldn't even find the button for it on the language screen, the non-translated words having fallen behind the open translated boxes. He took care as he searched, however, to keep the rolling numbers visible. 04, 22, 13, and counting. Meg had gone into stasis halfway through full red. Now the Eliban sun rose over the peaks, and they were in the thick of Eller Orange. By his calculation, Meg should be coming out of the shelter just as the Eller shift ended, early in high orange. He did some simple math. The countdown should be right around 024040. He could remember that. 244. At 030505, he shifted in the booth so he could keep an eye on Meg's shelter. He had found the pictures of night and hadn't even noticed how far into Eller Orange they'd gotten. The photographs were incredible, somehow capturing light against the velvet blackness of the Earth sky. He'd seen space. He knew that blackness, and he longed to see it again. He never imagined he would be seeing it captured on film over an alien planet. One sun. Earth had one sun. He had stumbled upon photographs of huge sections of the planet that were too cold to live in. They were white with ice. Ice on the planet. He'd only ever seen ice on the satellite lenses when they went above the atmosphere. He couldn't imagine these long, thin creatures, the Earthers whose skin was so delicate that wind rocks could cut them, being able to exist, to thrive on a planet extreme enough to have ice on its surface. At 025052, Cho moved to the door of Meg's shelter, sticking his head inside the flap. He climbed inside, medical kit in hand. Moments later, Meg emerged, rubbing her eyes against the sea wind and high orange light. She yawned and stretched her body into an almost comically long pose, her arms jutting from her body in a crooked line. Lul watched, applauding himself for being so close on his calculations, and saw Meg jump, clutching her wrist where the wristband usually rested. Her gaze flew to their booth, and Lul held up his hand in greeting. She blinked with that look she and the Earthers always seemed to wear when experiencing mourning. As he knew she would, she waved back and headed for the Earther waste station. Then she would get a water bag and either some tot or those strange green blocks and join him. The Earthers stuck to their schedules. They had routines and rhythms. According to his calculations, Lul had only to wait until high orange began to fade into far pale for the countdown to zero out. He'd know if his gut was right. He tried to prepare himself as he had all his life to be disappointed, to have overestimated the importance of what his imagination rendered. But the longer he spent on site with the Earthers, the more faith he put in his gut. He knew that after Meg arose, Agnar would go down for his period of stasis. Agnar always waited for the signal from Meg and Cho that they were back on site before heading into his shelter. This time, however, Meg and Prater finished in the waste station and signaled to the leader. He signaled back, and Lul watched the leader, Chefson, and Cho all check their screens. Only 2 units of Earther time remained on the clock. Nobody went down into stasis. Chapter 14. Lul. Meg was acting differently. It wasn't just mourning, and although he only understood part of what she said about Prater and stasis, he didn't think that was what made her seem different. Maybe he was just reading into it. Maybe staring at that countdown getting closer to zero had him imagining things. Meg's long fingers fluttered more than usual, and she didn't so much sit in the booth as fidget lower and lower until she settled in place. Her thumb flicked at the refill valve of her water bag, and she kept squeezing the clear plastic, forcing the bubbles up and down. She smiled and made a happy sound when she saw the pictures of Earth on screen. "Good. Very good," she said, pointing to a picture of rough sea underneath a multicolored sky, one lone sun sinking beneath the horizon. "Meg likes sea very much." She waved her hand in the direction of the Keter Sea, invisible but very much present behind the sight. Normally, Lul would have asked a question or picked another photograph or maybe even invited her to walk with him again to the edge of the worksite where they could see the water beating against the rocks. But he couldn't find it in himself to do any of those things. He couldn't think about anything but that countdown, and he wanted to see if Meg had noticed that he had noticed the numbers. If she had, she didn't make any sign of it. She also didn't seem to notice the change in their conversation tempo. Her fingers flitted through commands and prompts, topics and directions changing in no discernible order. Lul kept up with her, keeping his answers simple, keeping questions to a minimum. He felt calm, which surprised him since that ever-decreasing number seemed to tick off faster and faster the lower it got. A sense of inevitability misted down over him, a helplessness to whatever was going to happen as he watched Meg's gaze flit around the worksite, meeting the eyes of her crewmates. One to another, their gazes passed over the Didetto crews, never holding one spot too long, but always flickering back to their work screens. Back, Lul just knew, to that countdown. He saw the moment she knew she'd been found out. He'd asked an uninterested question about a large, leaping sea creature when Meg's gaze had shifted to Cho. Cho had been staring in Meg's direction, his long fingers pushing his lips back and forth. The Effins bustled around him, and he didn't seem to be listening. He didn't seem to be looking at anything either until Meg turned her face to him. Nothing remarkable happened. There was no big change of expression, and if Lul hadn't made a point of noticing how subtle the Urfers could be, he might not have noticed the gesture at all. Cho had kept his fingers over his mouth, his elbow braced on the Effins' high medical lab. When he and Meg locked gazes, he stopped rubbing his face. He stood very still, and Lul hardly even noticed when the longest finger on the Urfer's hand, the middle one, slipped ever so slightly over the first finger. Just the tips crossed, and only for a second, as if he were scratching an itch. It probably wouldn't have registered at all if Lul hadn't chosen that moment to glance back at Meg, whose hand rested on the edge of the table. Her fluttering fingers stilled when she looked at Cho. As Lul watched her, the first two fingers of her right hand twisted, second over first. It didn't look like a casual gesture when she did it. It didn't look like scratching an itch, and when Cho saw her do it, he dropped his hand from his face and went back to work. Lul didn't move when Meg looked back at him. He didn't scowl. He wasn't angry. It was too late to be angry. He'd told Meg he trusted her. He had let the media think everything was fine. The Urfer time units were flying by too quickly for anything to be done to stop whatever was going to happen. Whatever those looks meant, whatever those twisted fingers signified, whatever the Urfers, the aliens, he reminded himself, were waiting for was going to be here in just a matter of heartbeats, and Lul felt oddly free of concern. Whatever it was, he told himself, at least he'd be the first to see it. Meg sighed and brought her hand up between them. She twisted the fingers. Yes? She knew he'd seen them. There was no point in pretending now. He pointed to the numbers ticking down in the corner of the screen. 001204. Meg bobbed her head. Yes. When Lul said nothing, that strange sense of peace and surrender stilling him, Meg rested her chin in her hands, staring at him. Lul thought back to the first time he'd seen her do that, just a few rounds ago, although it seemed like a lifetime, and he'd wondered at the time if their heads were too heavy for their thin necks to hold them up. He knew better now, of course. He knew those thin limbs and long muscles were deceptively strong. Deceptively. Meg swept the light screen of the photographs, opening up a large blank box in the center. A big box usually meant a difficult concept. Well, they had 000954 time units to get there. Her fingers hovered over the screen, digging at the air the way they did when she looked for a way to start a concept. A thousand howling inevitabilities pounded in the back of his mind, trying to predict the revelation she was about to share. Invasion, explosion, conquest, uprising, escape. All the things any comic-reading kid knew followed the end of a countdown, and yet Lul found himself drifting in a peaceful absence of concern. Probably denial, something whispered in his head, but at least he felt ready for anything. Except that big white thing. Shaking her head and making a sound of impatience, Meg pulled the picture of the fat white animal that had shown up on the screen when the computers had interfaced. Turkey, she said, jabbing at the image. Turkey, okay? He didn't know what to say. So much for being ready for anything. Meg scrubbed her face with her hands the way Cho had been doing just moments before. Anxiety. That was the only thing the gesture brought to mind for Lul. Like they thought they could scrub unhappy thoughts out of their mind by scrubbing them off of their skin. After a few noisy breaths, Meg dropped her hands to the side of the screen, her fingers dancing lightly on the edges as she faced him. Her shoulders dropped, her head leaning forward in that full-body attention way she did. Lul felt himself responding automatically, her attention triggering his. 07-38-22. Lul need wants turkey, okay? She let one hand hover between the yes and no buttons, a sign that this wasn't exactly what she meant, their unspoken way of saying sort of or maybe or even hang on. He tapped his knuckles.
Okay.
He put his hand beside hers between the buttons.
Lul need want turkey.
He had no idea why he would need or want that hideous thing, but he would give it a chance. Okay. Meg took a deep breath, her fingers splayed over the screen. Meg need want Lul has turkey. Meg need want to Lul need want. She shook her hands, her fingers fidgeting over the screen in that way that told Lul she was frustrated. Muttering to herself, she pulled up the audio text combo boxes she had just pushed aside. Now that Kartar had filled in the boxes beneath them, Lul could read the boxes as she assembled them. She pointed to each box as she read it. Meg, need want, Lul, need want, turkey.
Why would you want me to want a turkey?
Lul asked, knowing it was the wrong question and that she couldn't understand it anyway. Or maybe she did, because she pushed down her palms in a gesture he'd come to know as wait. Turkey to Lul is okay good. She flipped the boxes in place, pointing as she spoke. Lul need want turkey.
Okay.
05-15-48. Meg, need want, okay good, to Lul. She touched Lul's hand and then pressed her palms together in front of him. Meg Lul. She pressed her hands harder together. Meg Lul, okay, good, yes? Meg trust Lul. Lul trust Meg. Okay, good, yes? He felt a warmth rising around his face. He knew what she was saying, or he thought he did. She was assuring him that they were friends. Considering how fast the numbers were counting down, the assurance didn't comfort him. But Meg continued, her focus drawing him in as always. Yes. Meg Lul, okay good. She ran her finger along the string of text boxes. At the need-want box between Lul and the turkey, she pressed the audio. Lul, need-want. Drawing her finger back to the text box between her name and his, she spoke again. This need want is... And she made a sound he could barely hear. It sounded like a sigh or the rush of wind. He watched her mouth as the machine recorded her word, but could only hear air pushed out between her pursed lips. The program filled in the new text box with Urfer symbols, but because he couldn't understand it and thus couldn't translate it, the Kartar box remained empty. He let his knuckles fall away. Meg bit her lip, seeing the gap in the program translation. She scrambled some more text boxes onto the screen. Lul need want turkey. Then Lul has turkey. This is good. A few jabs at the screen and she recorded another word. She held up both hands, the second fingers twisted around the first in that gesture she and Cho had shared. Lul stared at the text boxes. If he wanted a turkey and he got a turkey, it was this new word, this new gesture. He turned up the volume to hear more clearly and hit the buttons to play back the words. Lul get turkey. This is good luck. Meg held up her twisted fingers and glanced at the numbers as they sped toward zero. Meg need want good luck. Earthers need want good luck. Lul didn't think this had anything to do with turkeys. Meg. 00000. She could only imagine what he was thinking. He'd seen the numbers. Nothing good ever happened when a clock hit zero, at least not on Earth. He hadn't pressed her, and for that she would be eternally grateful, but the blind, helpless trust he put on her was almost worse than an angry confrontation. His thrum had softened. She'd heard it changing, lessening, as if he were drawing away from her. It hadn't been her imagination either. Nothing had changed with the Effens. Meg could hear them chattering away as always, and Kick and his crew seemed as determined as ever to do their damage despite Prater's distraction. Meg had heard Olam pound the table more than once trying to get a point across to Wagner. Jefferson dug and scraped his samples, but all of their minds were elsewhere. Only Lul seemed to pick up on the distraction. Only Lul seemed to want to call Meg out on her evasion. She tried to tell herself she was just projecting, but one look in his hooded gray eyes and she knew he knew. She tried to teach him the word wish, but like the concept itself, the word was too soft, too ethereal for him to pick up. So she'd gone with luck. She didn't know if he understood the concept or if the Didetto even had an equivalent word. It didn't matter now. The timer hit zero. She and the rest of the crew were going to learn if they had any luck at all. Lul didn't stop her when she rose. He didn't even seem surprised. She held her hands out, palm down, in an unnecessary gesture encouraging him to wait for her. He always waited for her. He had never let his attention flicker from hers since their first encounter. As she slipped out of the booth, she was grateful they hadn't tackled the concept of loyalty. Nobody needed to call out or signal. The five Earthers just moved as one to the clearing at the center of the site. Funny, Meg thought as they gathered in their usual circle. The whole site was packed with equipment and cables and work crews, and yet this ring, this little five-foot circle, repels clutter. She wasn't even sure the Didetto even walked through it. Some patches of dirt just seemed to create their own energy. Cho stood nearer to her than he usually did, not touching, but just an elbow bend from it. Prater gripped and flipped a wrench in her hands, holding on to it like the handle of a roller coaster. Jefferson rubbed his thumbs over his forefingers, loosening the grit from the creases there, grit that had long since become permanent. Wagner looked to each of them before opening his screen and raising a volume control that the rest of the crew had kept on mute. They all knew he'd kept the volume of this channel just at the edge of hearing range, his captain's ear incapable of not listening for it. They stood silently, waiting, the hot orange of the sun fading. Meg was thankful for that. After this period, the air would cool just a little, the light become a little less flame-like. She thought it was the time they called Fa something, because the light came mostly from the paler sun that always hung over the archiving station. Wagner would know. He'd made a point of knowing the suns and their schedules. She and the rest of the crew had just moved through the shifting light trying not to get sunburned or light blinded. Wagner paid attention to the suns. He was a navigator. The solar patterns directly affected this mission. He had to pay attention to them, just like he had to keep a certain audio channel open. They waited, hearing the unmistakable white noise of an inactive audio channel. Around them, the Didetto crews thrummed and muttered, curious about the withdrawal of their Earther teammates. From the corner of her eye, Meg saw Cruz heading toward Lul to ask him. Lul was the unofficial authority on all the strange behavior the Earthers exhibited. She wondered what he was telling them. Contact Damocles Sub 2. This is the Damocles. Contact, come in. As one, the five Earthers blew out a sigh of relief loud enough to be heard over the sea wind. Prater slumped forward, hands on her knees still clinging to the wrench. Jefferson bent backward, eyes closed, mouth open. Cho bumped against Meg, who had to cover her face with her hands. Wagner stayed still as he spoke.
Damocles, this is Sub 2. We have contact.
His voice broke on the last word, and he dropped to one knee.
It sure is good to hear your voice, Aronson.
The tremor in the usually unshakable voice brought the rest of the crew to the ground as well. They settled cross-legged, listening.
It sure is good to be heard, Captain. It was,
Static crackled, and Cho grabbed Meg's hand.
It was a little more exciting than I cared for, especially since I had to worry about your candy asses getting Roswelled down there. Can I assume Prater hasn't shot anyone yet?
They laughed, and Meg felt tension she hadn't even realized she'd been carrying running out her spine. Prater spun her wrench on the ground before her.
Don't assume anything, Aronson, and don't think you can help yourself to my stuff. My underwear had better all be in place when we get back.
Trust me when I tell you this, Prater.
Aronson's voice regained its stony tone.
There is nothing in this universe safer than your underwear. Jefferson's underwear, on the other hand.
Okay, let's knock off the chatter.
Wagner tried to sound stern, but his grin gave him away.
We still have a mission, and we've got a lot of confused Dideto around us wondering what the hell we're doing right now.
Oh, shit. Meg spun from the circle and found Lul's wide-eyed, flushed face staring back at her. She'd forgotten to turn off his comm. The other Dideto had earpieces, but Meg had restricted the channels they could access. Only Lul's had full access to anything she could hear. She'd wanted him to hear the interplay among the crew. He was fascinated by the tones and tempos, even when he couldn't understand the words. Now he heard a new voice, a voice he believed she'd lied about.
What's it like down there?
Aronson asked as Meg opened her screen. She didn't want to do this. She knew the message it would send to Lul, but what they were discussing here would be too difficult to explain. She didn't know what the verdict was going to be, and she couldn't let Lul stumble upon information he might misunderstand. There were limits to anyone's loyalty. She shut off his comm. His hand flew to his ear, tapping the piece as if he thought it had malfunctioned. When he realized the truth, he pulled the piece from his head, dropping it on the table. Meg held out her hands in that gesture that begged patience, but he turned away from her. For the first time since their landing, Lul turned his back on her.
Shit.
She turned back to the circle, shutting off her screen. Wagner raised an eyebrow at her, but she waved him off, one thing at a time. Prater, Jefferson, and Cho continued talking over each other, answering Aronson's questions about the planet, the people, the discoveries they'd made. They bragged about Meg's language breakthroughs and Wagner's computer interface miracle, and teased Cho about his new girlfriends. Aronson laughed, an unusual sound from the serious woman, and kept peppering them with questions. At first, they lost themselves in the happy conversation, but as the questions kept coming, Meg saw Prater raise a worried glance to Wagner. Cho took Meg's hand again, and while they kept up the chatter, the tension in the circle rose. Wagner, as captain, took the lead.
So now that you're light side again, we're going to relay this information back to the ship's database. We've got a megaton of information that's going to take 3 lifetimes to process, so we'll have plenty of work on our hands. But the pictures don't really do it justice. Officer Aronson.
He cleared his throat, the muscles in his jaw working to spit out the question.
Will you be joining us on the surface?
Static rippled through the comms, and the five of them leaned forward, unconsciously urging the answer from their crewmate. She took a moment before answering.
That's a negative, Captain. The Shellian crystal is not recovering. I repeat, the crystal is not recovering. I cannot put the system in automatic.
Even through the static, Meg could hear Aronson swallow hard around the words. The five on the ground grew very still.
Prognosis?
I believe the crystal is still viable. It hasn't shown signs of terminal damage, but as yet I cannot reactivate the growth cycle.
Aronson kept her tone level, her words technical, her speech familiar to all of them as that of a pilot in crisis. Aronson had been a combat pilot before becoming one of the most decorated deep space navigators alive. She knew more about Shellian crystals than anyone in the crew, and Meg knew her greatest asset was her ability to remain calm and realistic. If Aronson said the crystal was still viable, it was. That she wouldn't leave the system to automatically tend to the situation spoke volumes on the seriousness of their situation. Wagner's lips were pale around the edges where he held his mouth so tight.
Recommendations?
A direct injection. The space debris I've picked up in orbit hasn't had sufficient amounts of the silicates needed to reactivate the recombination. To be honest, I think all this damn solar radiation is burning off the elements we need.
They all heard the sound of something banging. Meg could picture Aronson in her navigation cubby hurling her coffee cup across the panel. That action was the equivalent of any of the other crew members having a complete histrionic meltdown.
What are you looking for?
Jefferson dug his nails into the dry soil.
We've got an abundance of Class 1 and 2 silicates within easy reach.
Aronson sighed, a whispering sound through the static.
I don't think we can do it without Class 4. Maybe we can hump and jump with Class 3, but I'm not going to lie. I haven't been feeling especially lucky lately.
They could hear her breath through the calm.
It's really good to hear your voices. These suns, that star pair we rode in behind, they do weird things with the light up here.
Meg shivered despite herself.
How are we with hard fuel?
The captain's voice was all business.
We've been better, but we're okay.
The sound of keys clicking came through beneath her voice.
Someone had the decency to smash up a pretty large moon a couple hundred years ago, and there's enough hard metal to keep the magnets busy. I've shut down all systems on the ship except mine so the cells can recharge. I hope nobody minds, but I broke into the whiskey to toast the innovator who decided to equip the Damocles with solar rechargers. We're going to have enough to break orbit and give her a good running start if, you know.
Yeah.
Wagner gnawed on the edge of his lip.
Jefferson?
The geologist pried a small stone loose from the ground.
We've got traces of Class 4, but so far I haven't found a solid source. Hopefully, now that the captain's started the interface, I can research the Didetto's files for the silicates. So far, I can't really figure out how they classify their minerals. Seems they don't break them down quite the same way we do. Plus, the surface is pretty uniform, at least where the drones have touched down.
Aronson cut him off.
It's not an accident that Class 4s tend to cluster in the black. Solar radiation and higher-class silicates, not exactly a love story. We didn't have them on Earth for that very reason. A planet with 7 suns? Well...
Meg only understood a fraction of the discussion. She knew the crystal needed certain elements combined at varying temperatures to reactivate. The crystal had been designed to operate in the cold void of space.
This hump and jump you're talking about.
Prater tapped the wrench against her open palm.
How much humping and jumping are we talking about? Can I retrofit the fuel cells for a little more jumping and save the humping for the deep space burn?
The sound of keys clicking came through the comms once more as Cho squeezed Meg's hand. She looked up at him and he gave her a shrug. So much of this propulsion talk was beyond him as well. He and Meg were the least qualified to make an engineering decision.
If we can get a large enough dose of some clean class 4s and you can boost our burn out of orbit, I think we can probably limp up enough speed to hump the crystal. I won't know until injection, but it's worth a look-see. Can you run a diagnostic down there?
Hell yes.
Prater threw down the wrench and pulled out her screen. Wagner looked to Jefferson, who worried smooth pebbles from the ground.
How about it, Jefferson? Can you find some clean class 4s? A sufficient amount?
His words rolled out with a heavy Galen drawl.
Well, it's a slightly larger needle in a slightly smaller haystack, so yeah, I think I can trace the traces, so to speak. Send me down some specs, Aronson, and I'll start digging.
Let me do some figuring, the pilot said, typing as she spoke. I'm going to try a few more things, you know, since I have all this time on my hands. Also, since the deep freeze isn't the answer, we'd save a lot of juice if I can drop down into closer orbit. I don't suppose you could clear that with your new friends? Keep them from shooting me out of the sky? I've been playing hide-and-seek with a couple of bad-looking satellites up here.
Wagner nodded.
They're decades away from having anything to reach you, Aronson, but we'll wait to see if they spot you. We don't want to start a panic.
Cho squeezed Meg's hand, and she realized she had drifted from the conversation after Wagner's remark about creating a panic. It seemed that everyone else's teams had enough hard data to distract themselves from the question of another Earth ship. The Didetta were nothing if not focused on their jobs. Only Lul had pressed the issue, and it had hardly been a press at all. Maybe it was a natural lack of curiosity, although she doubted that. Maybe it was politeness. Maybe the Didetto simply didn't evade questions, choosing to be honest at all times. That seemed impossible to imagine as a human being. Whatever the case, Meg had to face Lul now and try to explain what she had hidden and why. Before she could even begin to formulate how she would approach this, Aronson's voice caught her attention.
Here's the thing, Captain. If this works, if you find adequate silicates and if Prater can pull off a hump and jump on the thrusters, it's going to change our parameters significantly.
How so?
Sir, I know these crystals. I know this crystal, this kind of crystal. I've seen this kind of affliction before.
They could hear static crackle as she cleared her throat.
After the injection, we've got to let her digest it. If it takes, if she lets it in, she's going to be a shark. She's a shark.
A shark? Meg asked.
Yeah. If the injection feeds her, then she's got to move. She's got to move fast, and she's got to keep on moving for at least a year. If we can fix her, we have to leave.
Lul. The generals had their backs to him, talking into the heavy radio set as they always did just before Fa Pale, when the signal was clearest. They were filling in the presidents on the day's activities and discoveries. Lul knew they didn't know the biggest discovery of all. He had to tell them. He had to let them know that he'd been wrong, that there were more Urfers and that they were close, close enough to contact their ground crew. There was another ship, and there were more Urfers, and he had lied about knowing otherwise. He hadn't known, of course. None of them had. But by not admitting such in front of the world media, he'd let it be implied that he knew differently. He kept seeing Meg's face when she'd turned off his earpiece. She knew he had heard the voice. The expression on her face was yet another one he hadn't seen before. If he had to guess, and really wasn't that all he'd been doing this whole time? He'd have said it was a look of fear, like she was afraid the secret was out. Like she was afraid he would tell the generals and foil their plan. Was she afraid? Did she have a plan? Was it all a lie? The specter of being the man who had vouched for these Urfers, these aliens, these invaders to his planet, swooped down and pushed all the air out of his lungs. It was very similar to the feeling he'd known when he'd stood in front of the panel of officials and heard them laughing at his alien contact preparation report. The long-term repercussions weren't what hurt. He hadn't thought about the death wound he had just inflicted on his career. He'd felt only the humiliation. And now, Crouching down, watching the generals file their daily report, he felt the same immediacy of shame. Death, destruction, enslavement of his planet. Stupidly, they paled in light of going down in history as the man who didn't have sense enough to keep his guard up. The dork who'd treated the entire encounter like a ridiculous child's role-playing game. He had to tell them. Rising from his crouch, he banged his fists against his hips, trying to fortify his resolve. Then he felt the unmistakably delicate touch on his shoulder. Meg. He felt helpless to resist turning to her. Part of him hoped, as he'd hoped the very first time they'd shown their faces, that she'd have the courtesy to kill him first and spare him the shame. In the far pale, her skin looked colder, paler, like the skin of water snakes. Small patches of redness scattered across her brow where wind pebbles had struck her. Such a strange fragility. Lul. She held out her hand, unfolding the long fingers to reveal his earpiece. He hesitated and then took it from her palm. He didn't put it on.
More Urfers are coming, aren't they?
He knew she wore her translator. No. He ground his teeth at the lie. He wanted to crush the earpiece and shout to the generals, but then he realized what he had heard. She hadn't spoken through the earpiece. She hadn't spoken through the speaker patch. She hadn't even spoken in Kartar. She had said no in her language, a small puff of a word, and he had understood it. It still didn't make it true. He jabbed his fist toward the sky.
More Urfers are coming, yes?
No. She put her hand on his, pulling the earpiece toward his head, but he jerked his hand away.
Yes, Meg. Lul hears. Lul hears more Urfers. Urfers coming.
No, Lul. His name in her voice sounded so soft, and he had to fight losing himself in the fascination of her expressions. She dropped her head forward, letting it sway like a reed. Her wet eyes looked from his hand and the unused earpiece, then back to his face. Lul. No Urfers. He couldn't hear her voice over the wind and rumble of the machinery, but he understood her gesture. She lifted her hand to the sky and pulled it down, as if drawing down a string. She was telling him no Urfers were coming down. She swept her hand behind her, encompassing the worksite. Urfers, she said once more, and made another gesture that froze him to the spot. Without thinking, he tipped his head, falling back into their conversational habit of requesting a repeat. She made the gesture again, her eyes shining in the far pale light. He scrambled to put on his earpiece.
More Urfers coming, Meg? Yes?
His tone was softer now, almost pleading. The bad news he'd feared suddenly preferable to what he thought she was telling him. No, Lul. The translator left no room for misunderstanding. More Urfers not coming. This, Urfers here. She swept her hand in a graceful arc toward her team. Urfers move. Urfers move from Didet. Urfers go. The water that puddled up along the rim of her eyes overflowed, leaving tracks along the pale skin of her narrow face. She didn't wipe them away, and Lul thought that just maybe he could hear the sound of the drops hitting the ground at his feet. Chapter 15. Meg. None of the other conversations mattered now. The syntaxes, the subtleties, the yawning gaps in data. Meg couldn't make herself care about any of that now. She had less than 72 hours now to tell Lul all the things she'd wanted to tell him, to listen to him tell her everything she needed to know about him. She knew it was sentimentality, but even the now pale light seemed a little rosier, a little softer than usual. 72 hours left, and she didn't give a crap about Daidetto's political structure or cultural inclinations. She didn't want to upload their historical records or study the impact of the ancient message on their collective unconscious. She didn't want to do all of the things she had thrown herself across space for, because now that she had less than 72 hours, all she wanted to do was know Lule. This was assuming, of course, that the crystal injection worked. If it didn't, 72 hours would just be the warm-up for the rest of their lives spent on this sun-warmed world. Meg couldn't even begin to approach her feelings about that. The way Lule stared at her made it difficult to swallow. She knew her tears confused him, but she couldn't and wouldn't make them stop. She didn't really cry, at least not with any force, but the tears kept puddling up and spilling over her cheeks, and she just couldn't think of a reason to stop them. This whole mission had been such a fuck-up, and if there had been anyone she could put the blame on, she'd have beaten them within an inch of their life. They hadn't had time to prepare for contact, and now they didn't have time to wrap up the contact that they'd made. It made her think of those stories of people who went into the light after they died, only to get jerked back into their bodies upon resuscitation. It felt like hell. And this kind of wool-gathering and teeth-gnashing was exactly what the situation didn't need. But everything she could think of to start talking about seemed so trivial, so pointless in light of their impending departure, that all she could do was stare at Lule and let the tears fall. They had at least made it to their booth. All around them, the crews worked with a new urgency, although the Earthers had decided to keep the news of their departure a secret until they could be certain Jefferson could find a source of the proper minerals. "I'm going to tell Lule," Meg had said in a tone that accepted no discussion, and none had followed. "He won't tell." Cho had let go of her hand, and the 5 Earthers had gone back to work. 4 Earthers. Meg had rendered herself pretty much useless. Lule. He was a young man. He kept himself in pretty good shape. So how did he know his heart didn't have the strength to keep up with the shocks he kept putting it through? Just minutes before, he'd been ready to denounce Meg and her company to the generals as a threat to the safety of his home. And now that he knew they were leaving, it was all he could do to not arm-cuff himself to Meg's leg and demand she take him with her. Or at least lock down the ship somehow so they couldn't take off and fly away with the only interesting, worthwhile, and notable thing Lule Pell had ever been party to in the course of his entire life. He did none of those things, of course. He couldn't do anything but sit across from Meg and watch the drops of water slide down the long, pale cheeks. They didn't need the translator to explain those drops. Of all the conceptual leaps Lule had made since the Earther's wondrous arrival, he knew he correctly read the emotion on Meg's face, and although he hated to see her upset, he had to admit to himself he was glad she was sorry to leave. Meg was leaving. The Earthers were leaving. Like a sticky message that has lost its glue, the truth of those words just wouldn't sink in. Funny how it had been so easy for him to accept the fact that the Earthers had arrived, that aliens existed and wore pants and wanted to talk with him. That he'd gotten on board with right away. Throw a wrench into those plans, and his brain shut down like a social kitchen at cleaning time. He knew just what he wanted to do, what he needed to do. Meg would go along with him. There wasn't any more time to argue about it. Climbing from the booth, Lule held out his hand to Meg. He'd seen her intertwine her hands with Cho, had seen them walk the site together in the quiet moments before and after stasis. Clasping hands was something Earthers did when they trusted one another, just like the Daidetto. Her hand didn't fit into his the way a Daidetto woman's would, her long fingers wrapping almost all the way around his thick fist, yet barely wide enough to cover the tender pads of his palms, but Meg slipped her hand into his without a question. Her elbow knocked lightly against his shoulder as she loped along beside him, their intertwined hands bumping between them. It was a strange and awkward way to walk, and Lule loved it. 2 of the generals looked up at their approach, and the 3rd was dropped out on a low bench away from the table. General Ada watched Meg as if he expected her to draw a weapon and leap upon him.
Something on your mind, pal?
Yes, sir. I've come to requisition an air van.
Ada dropped the papers he'd been reading.
Are they moving? Have they agreed to be moved off-site? Well done, pal. Good work. We're going to use the cargo trucks for...
No, sir, you misunderstand me. The Urfers aren't moving.
Lul felt Meg's fingers shift and tighten in his hand. He explained his plan to the generals, who now stood shoulder to shoulder, faces darkening in surprise.
Impossible, Pell. Have you lost your mind? We don't have the security in place.
That's exactly why it will work, sirs. Nobody knows about it. Not Bado, not any of the media. Nobody knows we're coming, so nobody can plan any trouble. We bring some soldiers with us just in case, but nobody else will know. Make it happen.
He couldn't believe he dared demand so casually from the ranking generals on site, but something about the dwindling time made him bold.
Oh, and General Ada? I'm going to need my phone back. Now. We'll be at the air van.
Without another word, he led Meg from the general's setup to the small air vans parked at the edge of the barrier. As they moved farther from the worksite, Lul saw Meg checking over her shoulder, her eyes moving back where she could see her crewmates. When she saw the line of vehicles, she froze in place, her grip on Lul's hand tight enough to jerk him backward when he didn't stop with her. Move? Urfers no move. Meg no move.
Yes.
He stood in front of her, looking up at her and not breaking eye contact as his other hand reached for hers. They looked like a badly matched dance pair, he too short, she too nervous. Lul gently squeezed her fingers, careful of the shift of thin bones between his pads.
Meg go with Lul. One go. Meg see Kartar. Meg see Lul Didet.
Her eyes were wide, the brown centers surrounded by white all the way around. Meg Lul come back, yes? Meg need want come back here.
Yes. Meg Lul come back soon. Much soon. Now Meg Lul move. Good, okay.
Her smile took a moment to fully arrive, but when it did, it was brilliant. Okay, good. Meg Lul go. Talk this to Cho. She touched her earpiece and Lul heard the soft, bell-like sounds of her words punctuated by the lower sounds of Cho. Something in the scientist's voice sounded harsher than usual, but Meg smoothed it over. Touching her earpiece again, she looked to the air vans. Talk this? Meg. Wind truck. That was the closest she could get to the translation of the ingenious contraption she and Lul bundled into. On the ground, it had looked like a giant pill, oblong and smooth, all glass except for the top and bottom panels. Bench seats, low like all Didetto seats, ran the length of the truck, and Meg, Lul, and the 8 soldiers accompanying them barely left enough room to clamp down the clear door. The soldiers and Lul straddled the benches back to front, but Meg couldn't contain her curiosity. She clambered forward to look out over the driver's shoulder, watching his thick fists punching into the console, activating the mechanism. She expected to hear a loud motor like a combustion engine. Instead, she heard gears whirring and a metallic clicking on the overhead panel. Seconds later, the capsule lifted off the ground with a jump. She spun around to Lul for an explanation. Whatever he saw on her face made him laugh, and he reached out a hand for her. Maybe he thought she'd fall, but unlike the Didetto riding with her, she could easily brace herself on the ceiling of the truck. She saw more than one soldier's eyes go wide at how far her reach really was. Lul just kept smiling that smile she loved and tapped his knuckles against the bend of the glass beside him. Sails. Above and below the capsule, sails had unfurled, and then she understood why they called it a wind truck. Amazing, she said to nobody, high-stepping over the bench between Lul and a soldier, pressing her face to the glass for a better view. So mesmerized was she by the broad, billowing canvas sheets, It took her several moments to even realize what they flew over. Didet. The planet rolled along beneath them. Smooth, rounded structures with shaded glass ceilings, shaped and positioned such that she could see pale dust blowing like ribbons up over and around them. In the fading light of the palest sun, the glass ceilings seemed to shift and lighten, and if she squinted, Meg could make out walls and tables and moving figures within. Lul. He didn't know how Meg kept from tipping over in the unsteady air van. She didn't even need to keep her hand on the ceiling. And wasn't that a sight, that long arm shooting up, the fragile fingers splaying wide to grip an ungrippable surface? Where he and the soldiers had to press the low benches between their thighs to keep from being pitched around, Meg's reedy legs and whip-thin body somehow managed to ride the drafts, bending and balancing itself with a shift of her hips and a lift of her shoulders. Lul hadn't had many rides in an air van, but he found Meg far more interesting to watch than the windows of the city below him. He heard her voice in his earpiece and knew she spoke into the small microphone as she so often did, describing things for her database, taking note of details her camera couldn't pick up. She spoke too quickly for the translator to decipher, using words the computer hadn't converted, but the sounds she made sounded like delight. They had the long, lilting sounds she'd made when Lul had brought her fresh tut or shown her a comic book. They were the sounds that were often accompanied by the quick slaps of her palms together, although she didn't do that on board. Instead, she lifted one leg impossibly high, easily stepping over Lul's thighs and nearly shocking the soldier in front of him to death as she slotted in between them to press against the glass and watch the city fly by beneath them. Lul slipped his phone from his pocket, hating to tear his eyes away from Meg for even a second, but he had to send this message. His thumb moved quickly, rolling the letters out.
Get to the booth right now. Leave work. Leave everything. Booth. Now.
He sent it to Harkin Poe and, after less than a second of hesitation, to Reno Dotto. Meg. She never thought she'd see a day when she ran out of words, but watching the world flying by beneath her feet in this strange, silent wind truck, Meg thought she might be wrong. She commented on details as quickly as she could. Buildings disappearing behind her, she tipping the camera on her shirt forward to be sure it captured as much as possible. The first three rounds of drones launched from the Damocles had brought back grainy images, unfocused but for the largest details. The video drones were to have been launched much later, once the crew had some idea where to focus. All they had seen of Didet was what had flown toward them upon descent, and the images the newly interfaced computers revealed. This? Nothing had prepared Meg for this. No building was more than a story high, and all were rounded, topped with clear ceilings and dotted with large windows. It had never occurred to Meg that on a planet with six suns nobody would feel compelled to invent a light bulb. Now the thought made her laugh out loud, or continue to laugh out loud. Every turn revealed some new sight, colors shifting in the changing light, tinting the landscape with pastels. The pilot shouted something, and the soldiers braced themselves more rigidly on the benches. By now, Meg had thrown propriety.